Oh, this one is a comment. I pray that Francis, I think he means Pope Francis, take a card out of Francis of Assisi's regard for Claire in empowering her to guide the friars by ordaining women to guide his legacy after his death. Do I need to comment? Thank you for the comment. Please talk about the archetype, the imaginarium of the Marys. Oh, well, that's not in my appendix, is it? Receptive, trusting, kenosis, and heart opening, etc. If I remember correctly, Rohr conflates all of the Marys in Scripture together into one kind of super Mary as an imaginarium and as an archetype. And I don't know if I agree with that. I think each one was a distinct person and personality, and in her own way offers a particular insight. I don't think there's a conglomerate of Mary the Mother of Jesus, of Mary of Magdalene, of all the other Marys. Each one is a particular figure and of particular importance. But I would be interested in your comments. And do you find that appealing? Do you think of that? What do you think of that particular insight as one Mary or the Marys altogether as an archetype in our imaginarium?
I'll just simply say I think it's both and.
Okay. Both and. Thank you.
Well, while I'm up here, the break, I was talking about exemplars of darkness.
Yes, exemplars of darkness. Okay.
Light casts a shadow. So I guess my question that I was mulling over is, are they equal? If we say that the darkness can't overcome the light, so they're not really equal, and we would have to have darkness in order to have light. Light would have to cast a shadow. So I don't know, but they're not equal in my mind. The darkness is there, but at least that's what Scripture tells us, that the darkness is held by the light, something like that.
Yes.
Dawn, you
so
might
it
have
is, it
something
is, you're
more
saying
to say
the darkness
about that.
Is by its nature inferior to the light, and therefore cannot ultimately dominate.
It can't be equal.
Cannot
okay,
be equal to
anyhow,
the light.
Somebody else might want to comment.
Did you have a comment on that? Sure.
I do think that the darkness has its turn, and it can last for a while.
Yes.
And it could last for all of one person's lifetime, you know. So for them, from their perspective, the darkness is, so to speak, winning. But what I would go to for my sort of earthly verification is that we have both dark matter and we have matter that we can touch. And the scientists have come up with the matter we can touch exceeds the dark matter.
Really? How wonderful.
That's why we have creation.
Thank you.
If we didn't, dark matter is like antimatter.
Yes.
And it, you
yes.
know. And we would not have creation if they were equal, and certainly not if there was more dark matter than matter.
Thank you for stating the scientific and poetic terms. Now I can understand it.
I had an experience about 20 years ago. I came home in the evening, and I was walking down the hallway in our house, and I flipped on the light in the hallway. And then I opened the bedroom door, and I thought, oh my gosh, look at that. The light went into the dark room, but nothing of the dark came into the hallway.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Somebody was saying you could pass your whole lifetime in darkness. I think, imagine somebody born in Russia, the Soviet Union, the year of the Russian Revolution, 1917. They could have died at the age of 75 and had no idea what was to happen in the early 90s with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the change of all that. Their life would have been one in grayness, without having access to full information about the fullness of life, a constricted imaginarium over which they had no control. And that's tragic.
That's true. You can see some of that imagery in Madeleine L'Engle's books. She has a situation where that is, evoked. I wanted to mention in the connection with the light and darkness, I don't know whether you, Charles or Larry, have you ever been in Assisi in the month of May when there's this festival called the Calen di Maggio?
No.
Some of you, one of you knows this. Good. Okay. Well, I was there for a whole year on a Fulbright a few years ago, longer than I want to remember. And we went down to Assisi for this almost pagan festival of darkness and light.
Really?
And it plays itself out in two ways that are very interesting. One of them is that there's a competition between the upper and the lower town in Assisi.
Okay.
And it's a friendly competition. It didn't used to always be, because in medieval Italy, the upper town was often fighting with the lower town. And you know, you have these archetypal enmities throughout Italian culture, the Capulets and the Montagues, for example. So, but the way they resolved it in Assisi, to me, very interesting, a singing contest. They had the chorus from the lower town and the chorus from the upper town, and they went at it. And then they had judges. And one of the judges, you know, the judges awarded the prize to the best singers that year. And there wasn't any bloodshed. And then they had a pageant. And the pageant was kind of one of these celebrations of spring. And the way it worked was that there was a big float that on one side of the piazza, and it was all in black, and on top of it was the queen of the night, and her servants and minions pulled this thing into the square and all the way to the other side, almost as if to dominate everything. And then the white coach or whatever it was, float, comes in with the Queen of Light, and so she marches in and she disperses all the darkness. And this is a big deal in Assisi, and it's certainly not Christian. It's just almost bipolar in its symbolism of dark and light, you know. But this is the world I think that we live in, and Dawn, you're right. You can't ignore the darkness. It's there.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Hello, Father.
Hello.
Thank you for coming. While we're on the subject of dark and light, I thought I would share a different perspective I saw last night and on TV, and it was fascinating. This was a science experiment on the brain, and the whole premise was there that we are hardwired for community. But depending which buttons are pushed, the community button, depending which way it is pushed, can turn us into monsters or angels. And they showed, and it was done in the context of how quickly genocide can happen. Very good people turning very evil. And one of the experiments that was done was spontaneously done by a first grade teacher. And she decided, and it was after all the riots in the 60s and Martin Luther King, and Martin Luther King had just gotten shot. So she told the children, today we're going to divide the class. The brown eyes sit in the back, the blue eyes in the front. Okay. Brown eyes are bad eyes. You are not to play with brown eyes, not in the playground. And instantly the blue-eyed kids were really happy that they were in the front and together. And two gentlemen that are now in their 60s were in the front blue-eyed row. And this man said, I couldn't believe how quickly, and now seeing the recording of this, he said, I turned into an instant little Nazi. I came up with ideas that we should bring sticks to keep the brown-eyed in the back and to keep them in line on the playground. And anyway, it turned very ugly very quickly. But the next day, she said, today is a new experiment. The brown eyes are good eyes. The blue eyes are bad eyes. And she put them in the back, and they got the experience from the other perspective. Well, now as adults, they say they never, never forgot the lesson never to judge by appearances or the color of the skin. And the conclusion was, if kids were to experience how it feels to be excluded, because the science part of it was, we have a very strong need for community, and but when we are not given that, we experience very deep pain. And anyway, it was the best lesson in treating everybody in a unitive way that they could have learned, and they never forgot it. Nobody in the class ever forgot that, never became a racist. Yeah. And anyway, it was an interesting way to see the dark side of humanity, you know. I thought I would share that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm looking to see if there are any other goodies in here. Somebody did ask me about the term Laudato Si. That's old Italian. Francis was the first poet in the Italian language. And it means, praise be to you, O Lord. Laudato Si, O Signore. Praise be to you, O Lord. And it's also called the Canticle of Creation.
Thank you for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
One point I took away from Appendix 3, which I did read twice, I think. That roar, that I understood roar making, was that the amount of attention paid to the more literalism of biblical stories, for example, is really not a very good use of our time or productive in leading us along a spiritual path. And I was interested what your thoughts on what he had to say there were.
You're quoting roar as saying that they're following the literal words of a scriptural pass.
And he said several things, but one of them was, he says, it really doesn't matter whether this happened or not, or it happened exactly that way, and spending time arguing or discussing whether or not it happened this way or that way is really not very productive to our spiritual lives.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of a trip I took with Father Larry and some other people here to the Holy Land last year. You know, the Holy Land, a guide will tell you, it happened right here, or actually, it might have happened over there. Well, it happened somewhere around here, but it really happened. And that really happenedness is always, there's always some element of something that really happened. Even if it's just the writing of a story, which in every other aspect is fictitious, the writing is an historical, documented, material experience. And we need to pay attention to that, because the soil from which things emerge is extremely important. I thought that was just a throwaway comment of his, and I thought, that's not really digging deeper enough. You know, the scriptures are for people who are not of the fundamentalist bent, the scriptures are multivalent. So you take some things very seriously and very literally, according to the way which the message has been conveyed in the community over time, and other things you can put aside, and other things you can say, this is poetry, this is symbol, this is archetype. But you can swim in and out of those waters. You know, be a deep sea diver. So why be constricted to just an archetypal meaning when a physical or historical or cultural meaning may enrich the context? And the funny thing about the scriptures, in case you haven't noticed, is it's always like changing. You come to the same passage, but we don't come to it as the same person every time. So we filter through our experiences, and if you read something when you're 10, and you read something when you're 50, and then again when you're 75, the things that you brought with you, which seem to be baggage sometimes, are also ways that help to deepen and enrich the experience. So the words themselves, the content of the word, the context of the word, the historical environment, the cultural richness of it, that all counts. Sorry, Richard, I don't agree with you. And I my one reflection, if I may say so, on the book in general, is, I don't know if you would agree or not, but maybe it's just me, but I thought it was a very difficult book. And for me, I was trying to figure out, why is this so hard for me? Because I'm a Franciscan, he's a Franciscan. I should like get this immediately. It should be a no-brainer. That's not the way it works. I really felt that what he has tried to do, at least in this book, is that he has done everything he could to take something which is out of the realm of poetry, out of symbol, and put it into comprehensible prose. And his filter then is the filter of his own education and his own academic preparation and predilection. So it's the filter of philosophy. It's the filter of certain kinds of theology. It's the filter of his own life experience. You notice how he always peppers things with little things like, when I was in this class and I had that experience and so on. And I thought, well, where's all that coming from? What does it have to do? But it's like this kind of a philosophical biography of Francis is not grounded so very much in the material experience of Francis. He doesn't refer to various moments in Francis's life, his experiences, his stories, things that happened to him or the early Franciscan community. He has really taken him in all of his symbolic essence and then done a meditation around that, which I think is specific and personal. I think it is his gift. But it's not everybody's gift. So there are multiple ways of experiencing this phenomenon. There are not just books about Francis. There are libraries about him. And every single one contains no more than just vestiges of the person who's embarked upon that change. I don't know if that comment is helpful or if you share that insight, Phil. If you disagree, I'd love to hear from you. Anything else?
As we were talking a little earlier about the different Marys in Christianity and that type of thing and how they could be viewed in different ways and or as an archetype of one, I've studied several religions and around the world the divine feminine is very important in most religions and the different examples of women that existed in the past and presently exemplify the divine feminine, and that's an interesting to think about.
And how did you experience that in terms of this book?
I don't know if I can answer that. Okay. I don't remember.
That's okay. But the whole idea of the divine feminine is so very important. I experienced that in a practical way. Two experiences. One was in Turkey, in the town of Ephesus. Have any of you ever been to Ephesus? You know, there's a shrine. You know, the legend, the tradition is that Mary's house was airlifted from Jerusalem or Bethlehem or whatever, and then in Nazareth, and then it was placed in this place in Turkey. But there's a church there, and a chapel, I should say, or maybe I better say it's a place of worship. What I thought was really extraordinary is the central aisle is a Roman Catholic chapel. One side chapel is an Orthodox, Greek Orthodox chapel, but the other side is a Muslim place of worship with the names of Maryam inscribed in Arabic, you know, in this beautiful tile lettering along. And so the Muslim people have a deep devotion to Mary. And according to their understanding of her, I don't know enough about Islam. I know very little to know if it's the same way that we look at Mary, but there is devotion there and there's a drawing there that really goes across cultures. And the same thing happened I went to visit the village of Medjugorje in Bosnia-Herzegovina. It was one of the only villages in that entire country which was never bombed or taken over by one group or another. It was a safe zone during the entire thing, the whole thing that was going on with the breakup of Yugoslavia into its distinctive republics. And while I was there, there were lots and lots of Muslim families coming there to pray. They said, if Miriam, as they call her, has been here, then if she has visited us, we have come to honor her. Very interesting, huh? Okay, so we'll just let that be.
Hi, Father Charles.
Hello there, Gloria.
Thank you for your time here and your beautiful and excellent talk. Couple things. One is, did Francis come before Duns Scotus, or who was the first one?
Well, he was the chicken that came before the egg.
Okay. Similar time period?
Yeah, Duns Scotus came later. Duns Scotus came after Francis and studied in Paris. Scotus means from Scotland. He said, what did he say? Scotland created me and England made me. So.
Yeah. So he, would you
Germany,
say?
Germany, what did he say? Germany, and
yes.
Germany buried me because he's buried
in Germany. I remember.
Thank you.
So would you say Duns Scotus put some of Francis' ideas into theology?
Yeah, because Francis was not a philosopher. And so the gift of the early people like Bonaventure and Duns Scotus was really to take Francis and then give him a different vocabulary. Francis was a poet. He was an artist. And so many of the things that he was and explained to people were just the way he was with people, which was, left an indelible imprint on them. And his ideas were in that realm. They just wasn't concerned with messy details or being consistent, whereas other people really are. And Scotus really took the fruit of that mystical revelation and experience, and then put it in a way that's comprehensible to people, and also really kind of like, I don't want to say fit categories of thought at the time.
Right.
And it, and for him, it was, in the 13th century, an exploration. It's not something like the blow the dust off the book and what does he say, and is this a recipe or cookbook?
Right.
It really was an exploration.
So would you, did you finish?
No, go ahead.
Well, so with Francis, it seems like the heart came first, or it was a bigger part of him, and Clara helped explore that and put it into different, or put it into language and write it down. Something like that. But that's not my point. My point is, Duns Scotus, let's see how I can say this. The difference between Duns Scotus and Thomas Aquinas is the head and the heart and that whole thing. Can you explain that?
I cannot explain to you Thomas Aquinas and Duns Scotus.
Okay. But one.
But I think there is, I think Thomas Aquinas, everything else to the contrary, was a mystic. And he was operating from the heart, but he expressed himself in the categories of thought and in the kind of intellectual formation he received and which he imparted to other people. And Scotus, I think, was not in contradiction to Thomas Aquinas. We often talk about Scotus as being an alternative orthodoxy.
Yes.
It's never been rejected. And if I can remember some of my Scotus a little bit, dusting it off just for right now, I said, you know, Scotus says, God's love is so great for us that even if human beings had never fallen, even if Adam and Eve, in a mythical sense, had never sinned, Jesus still would have come to be with us out of love. And that there is this itinerary from love to us and then returning to love. And on the return trip, Jesus is taking us with him back to the Father. Okay, so that's mystical, it's poetic, it's prayerful. But it's not Thomas Aquinas' categories of thought. But that is certainly would never be to denigrate or to dismiss Thomas Aquinas. It's only that his particular approach to things has been so completely and overwhelmingly dominant in Catholic studies for the last 800 years that it's only the last 100 years that the authorities in the Catholic Church said he's not the only source of theology.
Well, that's my point.
It's okay to do a little more theologizing.
Yeah.
You know, it's all right. We can do it.
Okay.
So it doesn't help at all.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Because it just gives another perspective.
That was great.
All right.
You're a theologian.
I don't think so.
At the old mission. The other thing, I don't know. The other thing I wanted to say is see if you can expand on this. People, and many people say, and we talk a great deal about us all being one.
Right.
And that the light overcomes the darkness, and that's, to me, that's true. But there is still evil, I believe.
Yes.
That's my personal thing. Right. But we're all one body. We're all one. But there's no distinction between evil in that explanation. Are you with me? It's out there. Maybe somebody can help me. But there's this theory that we're all one and there is no evil. That to me, it's like when we come into the light or whatever we call it, light or Christ, that we still have some shadow to work out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also people that don't believe in that. I don't know if I'm explaining it right, that there's no evil whatsoever, that we're all one.
Well, what do you make of that?
I think there are people that don't choose to be in the light. They don't want to be, or they haven't. Their culture has hurt them, or whatever. I don't know. It's kind of, I don't know.
But it brings us to another level: is does evil exist?
Yes,
because you said
for
there
me.
Are some people believe that evil does not exist. I don't think they've checked the internet, the news today.
Okay, enough so that, said. Okay.
But does that help you? I wasn't making light of your question. No, but yeah, but the existence of pain and suffering is an absence of completeness. I mean, certainly we hope for completeness.
So we're not maybe not completed yet in the oneness. Maybe that's the way to put it. Okay, there you go.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Barb, hello.
Hi. I want to say that for me, Rohr's book is a compilation of, not compilation, it's a consolidation of where he's come from in his history of working with us and his spirituality and sharing that with us. And I've read his works over the years, and I felt that this was really a revelatory. It was a coming together of all the kind of things that he's been talking about for years, but he does put it together in this book for me.
This moment,
and
this moment.
Especially in the chapter on SCOTUS and the one on Bonaventure, and the speaker that we had, Brother Jude, here, really emphasizing and breaking us loose from the categories that we learned as children and grew up with. I did not have a Franciscan education. I had a Jesuit education.
We'll still talk
all the way through.
Thank you.
So I'm breaking loose of that, I guess. But I do appreciate, because these are problems in our thought categories. And I think, for me, Rohr and SCOTUS and Bonaventure and the Franciscan element has really been insightful.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you for your insights. Appreciate them so much. I have to say, there were two things I was looking for in Rohr's book that I didn't find, and to me they seemed absolutely foundational to the example of Francis and Claire, and that is poverty and joy. And they weren't there. I kept looking for them. I said, well, yeah, they're somewhere. But they're not. And that's absolutely essential to an understanding of what the Spirit is about. That's why we would get up and sing Laudato Si at the end of a lecture, as opposed to say, and thank you very much for any questions. Okay.
I'd like to give a shout out for the Divine Feminine.
Please.
It's in today's first Mass reading.
Okay. Oh, Wisdom, chapter 7. There we go.
What I want to say is, I think, personally, as a woman in the Catholic Church today, that one of the sins of institutional Catholicism today is its failure to raise women to the level, the feminine, to the level of the divine. And thus saying that there's some deficiency in being feminine. But here is what, if we really took seriously the Book of Wisdom, then Catholicism could have used the Book of Wisdom to help women understand their value and worth. So here it is. In wisdom is a spirit, intelligent, holy, unique, manifold, subtle, agile, clear, unstained, certain, not baneful, loving the good, keen, unhampered, beneficent, kindly, firm, secure, tranquil, all-powerful, all-seeing, and pervading all spirits, though they be intelligent, pure, and very subtle. For wisdom is mobile beyond all motion, and she penetrates and pervades all things by reason of her purity. She is an aura of the might of God and a pure effusion of the glory of the Almighty. Therefore, naught that is sullied enters into her, for she is the refulgence of eternal light, the spotless mirror of the power of God, the image of his goodness. And she, who is one, can do all things and renews everything while herself perduring, and passing into holy souls from age to age, she produces friends of God and prophets. For there is not God loves, be it not one who dwells with wisdom. For she is fairer than the sun and surpasses every constellation of the stars. Compared to light, she takes precedence. For that indeed night supplants, but wickedness prevails not over wisdom. Now, what a statement about the deep divine feminine.
Thank you. You know, when you were speaking, it would remind me of something I heard someplace that if you have new knowledge and understanding confronts old knowledge, that the loser is the old knowledge, and that's where the resistance comes. The resistance is those who are holders of old knowledge that will not embrace new understandings and new knowledge, and they sometimes will go to the barricades for it. simply to hold on to the old for its own sake, because they've so closely identified themselves with the old. They cannot conceive, they can't break through their personal illuminarium or terrarium to break through to something else. And we're living the consequences of that struggle. We live it every day. It's just, I mean, when I think of more than 50% of the women's of the world's population are women, and 70% of the population of the Catholic Church consists of women, what in the world is going on? People are not, it's the resistance of the old, the vested old, to something new. Anything else?
I just wanted to kind of piggyback on what Barbara said about the book. And I think it was in Rohr's book, he says that there's so many books written about St. Francis in Washington, whatever that place is, that he's got the most books of anybody. And Richard didn't want to go into his life. He was born. This book is different than that. It's the way of his thinking. It isn't the sequence of his life. So I got a lot out of this book.
What was most attractive to you about this book? What did you find most rich and new and different for you?
Well, I we're all seekers. I'm a seeker, and I think that's why we're all here.
Sure.
And I think he emphasizes it's okay to think other than the dogma and the things that we learned in second grade.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay for us to explore and talk and be ourselves.
Yeah.
And those are the kinds of things that go through all his books, and that's why I like to read them.
Thank you. Because I was thinking a lot when I was reading the book, it's like, how did Francis do it? How did this untethered spirit, a free spirit, exist and coexist in a realm, an environment, an institutional environment, and world, because Western Christianity was a whole world. How was he able to not only to survive, but to thrive? And to think that Innocent III, the Pope of Rome at the time, was the single most powerful person in the world. And how did this little person pop out of nowhere with his ragtag group of friends, and how is he able to touch the heart and soul of somebody whose entire life was posited in and expressed as power and control? And he was able to break through that mold to touch someone, be the last person in the world, be like Dorothy having a real heart-to-heart and negotiation session with the Wizard of Oz. You know, it's like, they're right behind him and confront you, what are you up to? But he did that, and he did that consistently throughout his life. Consistently. And that's the part of the biography I wish had been introduced. How does someone who is introducing the new into a realm filled with so much resistance, how do they not only survive, but how do they survive? He didn't protect himself. He was vulnerable. He was open. But he introduced a new category of thought which was not threatening to the old categories of thought. If he had come on gangbusters and speaking in the categories of the language of his time, people would have just... They would have done with everybody else. They would have branded him as a heretic and either exiled him or burned him at the stake. But he survived, and not only that, the space was made for him in an environment which one would automatically think would be exclusionary, and there would be no room for this man at the inn. That's it. So, thank you. Your ideas got me thinking too.
I have my own theory about that, based on the story in the Gospel, the parable in Matthew, of the widow who kept pestering the judge. Francis knew how to pester in the right kind of way.
Okay.
He went before the Pope many times, and finally they just said, all right, give him his order that he wants. Yeah. But if he hadn't done that, if he'd gone quietly back in defeat, we might not be talking about this man's life the way we are now. But I think he was so focused.
There's another element in the story, and that is the Pope had a dream.
Oh, yes.
And the Pope had a dream of this man who was holding up the church. So there again is a sense of, somebody once asked, where was inspiration in all this exemplary thinking? Where is the room of the spirit? It's embodied. It's part of what it is. So because he was a spirit bearer, that spirit affected, changed this man, Pope.
We call it synchronicity nowadays.
Synchronicity.
But it happens today.
It doesn't happen today?
It does happen today.
It does happen. Wow. Yes, we hope for that.
We just don't recognize it for what it is. Call it coincidence, but it isn't.
No, synchronicity. And I would like to go to your point that he had a strategy. That there was a lot more to Francis than just, you know, brother, son, sister, moon. You know, there was a lot more to him.
He was not just floating out there
in a
cloud of goodness. He knew exactly what he wanted.
Yeah, and he was willing to work for it and suffer for
it. Give up
and be extraordinarily patient for it. What other people were just be caused to become more polemical or to withdraw or to go on the attack. And he had these strategic maneuvers. Thank you for saying that, because it helps me to see it in a new way, to get what he was called to do.
Yeah, I think if the Pope told me no, I'd burst into tears and go home. But
maybe he did that.
Maybe
it was one of those times. I'm sure he had his tears. Thank you so much. Anybody else?
I just think that's what makes Pope Francis so attractive, because it's such a rarity in this culture these days, is the humility. The idea that this is not about me. Right. And Francis had that in spades. You know, I mean, the making it happen because it was the right thing to happen was more important than being rejected all those times.
Yes.
Had to go back and make it happen because it was important to make it happen. So the humility just takes over. Yeah. And that's what makes Pope Francis so attractive, too.
Thank you.
Well, the witching hour has come. It's now 12 o'clock. And let's all give a huge hand to Father Charles for all of his contributions.